So I got interested in the question of declining sperm count way back in the mid 90s. And a group of us were on a committee, were trying to figure out those chemicals that had been called endocrine disrupting chemicals, chemicals that alter your body's hormones. The committee was asking, well, are they really bad for human health? That was our charge, to figure that out. And so the committee said to me, there's this paper that just came out a few years ago, and it says that sperm count has declined dramatically over the past 50 years. Do you think we should pay attention to this? And I looked at the paper and I was skeptical. I thought, that's pretty extreme and doesn't seem to be a lot of data here, and probably not. But it was important enough that I decided I would spend a bunch of time figuring it out. And so what I did was I got the 61 studies that had gone into that analysis, and I looked at each of them and thought of things like, well, maybe the method of counting sperm had changed over time. You can see how that would lead to a lower count. Perhaps if you, the way you counted, just counted fewer sperm, that could cause a trend. Not a real one, but an apparent trend. Or maybe the men in more recent years just had poor sperm count because they came from different populations. Maybe they were men coming in for problems in a fertility clinic. Maybe the men were fatter. Maybe they were smoking more. Maybe whatever. So I went back and I looked at all those things and tried to put them in the model and see if they accounted for the trend. And the surprising thing was that after I spent 6 months on this analysis, by the way, nothing changed. Not to the first decimal place. It was astounding. I seldom have seen such a stable result. The decline was very significant. It was a straight line, and it was very concerning. So at that point, I said, wow, it seems to be something going on here. Let me look into this further. And then I spent the next 20 years doing that. And I published a series of papers which actually strengthened at each step that result. And finally, in 2017, I published a study with colleagues, seven of us published the study that said that there had been a 59% drop in total number of sperm in a sample between 1973 and 2011, 39 years. I call this the 1% effect. The 1% effect is a change of 1% per year over a lot of years. So if sperm count declined 50% in 50 years, that would be 1% per year. But a 50%, that was about what we saw. We saw actually a little worse than that. But a 50% decline means cutting it in half. Cut your sperm count in half. I don't think anyone wants to do that, right? It's the same thing with testosterone. It's also been going down at that same rate, 1% per year. Miscarriage or pregnancy loss has gone up in women at that same rate, and so on and so forth. We don't have good, solid data on all of these. We have much more limited timeframes for these other things because there are many more studies on sperm count than there is on testosterone, for example, trends. But where we can look at it, everything seems to be progressing at about the same rate of deterioration, if you will, of reproductive function. So wherever you look at it, it's not just men and it's not just women. And by the way, it's not just humans, because there are many, many species that have had their genitals disturbed significantly by the same things that are affecting us, and we can talk about what those are. And they've also had their litter size decreased, and they're, you know, basically their species endangered by their declining fertility and reproductive function. So the data overall is showing us for the world as a whole, back in 1960, an average couple had 5 children. That's the whole world. Now they have a little less than half that, 2.4 children. That doesn't sound too bad. It's still over replacement. But when you dive into specific countries like the US, like Asian countries, you see the situation is a lot worse. And surprisingly, Mark, everybody is declining. All countries are declining. In fact, the countries you think, well, they're not declining, like East African countries, they're actually declining at a sharper rate, because they're starting at a higher point, right? So you have this overall decline in fertility. And normally, the shape of the population in terms of age is a pyramid. So very few on top, a lot on the bottom, a lot in the middle, and the middle supports the top and the bottom, right? But what's happening now, and you can see that in the pyramid in Asian countries, is that the bottom is shrinking pretty dramatically. There's a bulge in the middle, and the top is growing hugely because people have longer lifespans. So longer lifespans is a great thing. I approve of that, of course. But in terms of support, they're not going to have the money for Social Security. That's already a threat in this country. They're not going to have the money for Medicare. They're not going to have the resources to support this older population in terms of, you know, medical treatment. And you're not going to have the labor force necessary to drive the economy. It's that middle sector that drives the economy. And it's going to have huge economic implications. And many economists are looking at that now. It doesn't look good. Yeah, what is causing this is really so complicated. I think the first thing to say is that if we look at what can be a cause of a trend overall, whether it's a cause in obesity or a cause in autism spectrum disorder, the first thing you might ask is genetics. And so if we look at this decline in sperm count and fertility, it's too rapid to be evolutionary. It's happened in two generations. 50% decline, that's not going to be genetic. Okay, so let's just put that aside. Okay, not genetic. All right, so what are you left with? Well, causes are broadly classified into genes and environment. Okay, so now we're on the environment side. Okay, so now what makes up environmental causes? Well, I subdivide them into lifestyle, and that's very broad, and I'll say a little more about that, and then chemical. Okay, so there are other things perhaps, but let's just talk about those. So lifestyle is pretty easy to understand. If a man or woman is obese, they're going to have more trouble getting pregnant. Obesity is related to lower sperm count. Smoking. If a man smokes, his sperm count is going to be reduced. If, by the way, his mother smoked when she was pregnant with him, his sperm count is going to be reduced. So smoking is playing a role. Large amounts of alcohol in a small time called binge drinking is also associated with lower sperm count. Stress, surprisingly perhaps, is also associated with lower sperm count, lower fertility, and so on. So all of these come under the, you know, in the bag of lifestyle factors, something we have some control over, right? Then over here are the chemicals, and those are things that we may or may not have control over. And the class of chemicals that I most worry about are the ones that affect our body's hormones. And the reason is that reproductive function, sperm production, pregnancy, and so on are controlled by the hormones, right? Everybody kind of knows that, you know, your testosterone you're going to worry about, your estrogen, if you're a woman, you know what your cycle is, that your hormones go up and down, everyone knows that, right? So all of that function is controlled by the body's hormones. Now, if you mess that up, you can imagine that you're messing up the end product, right? The sperm, the eggs, the pregnancy. And that's what happens. Okay. And so you might ask, well, what can do that? What can mess with that? And that is a huge class of chemicals, which are called endocrine, meaning hormone, disrupting, messing up chemicals, or EDCs. I like to call them hormone hackers because they sometimes pretend to be hacker, you know, hormones. They get in there, they hack the hormone system, they mess with it. And turns out that they're in our daily lives in huge numbers, huge numbers. So that's what I study mostly. So it turns out that after conception, in utero is the most sensitive time for the development of almost everything. Some things develop later, the brain is later, the brain continues to develop after birth and so on. Body size develops later, but the building blocks of what's going to be your reproductive system are really laid down early in the first trimester. So that's a very sensitive period. And so what the fetus is exposed to, which really means what the mother is exposed to, because, you know, there's no sort of barrier. There's no barrier protecting that fetus from what the mother's exposed to. It gets into her bloodstream, goes into the fetus, goes in and does its damage in the fetus. Okay, so anything that the mother is exposed to that's going to change her hormones or the fetus's hormones are going to be concerning if you're worrying about reproductive function. And let's dive in now. Just try to dive into the fetus and look there at the developing genital tract. It's a hard thing to think about. It's very, you know, microscopic. But there's this genital tract, which initially is the same in males and females, genetic males, genetic females. It's identical. It's just a single ridge. Then at a certain critical time, which we know exactly in the rat and less precisely in the human, but it's going to be early in the first trimester, the fetal testes starts making testosterone. This is a very, very important event for everything that's going to follow in the story. So this undifferentiated genital tract, if it's a genetic male, gets the testosterone and starts, if you will, waking up, starts becoming a genetically typical male. Okay? So the testicles start developing and so on and so forth. All the parts start developing. What happens if there isn't enough testosterone? Well, that process just doesn't get completed. Or if maybe the testosterone is too late, it won't get completed. So what that means is that it's going to be the default, which is female. This is a hard thing to imagine, you know, that the female is the default, but that seems to be what it is. And so if the male does not see enough testosterone at the right time, his journey to the genetically typical male genitals is not complete. And I like to say he's incompletely masculinized. Okay. Well, I should just first tell you that this was discovered in rats first. By the way, I want to put a plug in here for rodent experiments, which are invaluable in learning about human health. We can't do it without that. So I had heard from a friend on an airplane flying to Japan. He said, Shauna, you should look at phthalates. I said, why should I look at phthalates? And he said, well, I'm a chemist. I'm at CDC. We've been measuring these. They're in everybody, including pregnant women, everybody. And in the arm of the government that tests for chemical toxicity, they've shown that they disrupt the reproductive development of the male. In fact, they cause something called the phthalate syndrome. So my ears perked up because, you know, there's not very many syndromes that are assigned at birth. There's fetal alcohol and there's the phthalate syndrome. So that made it sound really important. So I asked him what that was, and he told me that when a rat has been developing, gestating within a mother rat who's been fed phthalates at the right time, then his genitals are all smaller. They're all smaller and less developed. So his testicles might not be fully descended and the penis might be smaller and the whole size of the area is smaller. Well, it turns out in all mammals, the genital size is 50 to 100% smaller in females than males. That's just how it is. Some exceptions, but almost all mammals. Okay. A particularly important measure is something called the anogenital distance. It's just, I don't know if you know what the taint is, the gooch, the grundle, those are street terms for this distance. That's the distance from the anus to the genitals, basically. You can measure it. We measured it in our study. They measure it in the rat study. So I heard about this rat study and I thought, that's funny. I wonder if we'll see that in humans. And so I designed a study to look at that. It was the first study to do that. So it got turned out was kind of important. So we had urine stored from pregnant women and we sent them to CDC and we had CDC measure what's called the phthalate metabolites. Phthalates, which are chemicals that lower testosterone, pass through the body really quickly, enter the urine, they're water soluble, and you can measure them. So we did that for about 800 women, had the CDC measure their phthalates. And then we said, okay, let's get the kids in and measure their genitals. Seems like a simple project, right? Turned out it was fairly complicated to do. It was hard sometimes to find the kids and bring them in and all that, but we did that and we found the phthalate syndrome in humans. So let me just reiterate. We found that when the mother had higher levels of certain phthalates, those that lower testosterone, in her early urine samples, that her male child would have genitals that were less completely masculinized. I hope that sounds dramatic, because I think it really is important. And because we had to replicate this, as you do with science, we wrote another grant, we got another big study, we got another set of pregnant women, got their urine, got their babies, replicated it, and found the same result. So now it's pretty well established that this is going on. There's two kickers here. One is, these children from our second study are now only 10 years old. We don't know how they're going to perform, you know, in terms of fertility and function later on. The first study, the kids are actually in their 20s, but they're really spread out around the country. And we are going to try to get them in and get their sperm count, but we don't know if we'll be able to do that. However, in the rat, we know that if the rat is born with a small anogenital distance, then when he grows up, he will still have, for his body size, a small anogenital distance. It's like, I have very small hands. I've always had small hands. I'm a small person, you know what I mean? But the portions of your body tend to grow with you. So you could ask, okay, an adult man who has a short anogenital distance, what's his sperm count like? In other words, does the shortness of the anogenital distance matter for his later function? You see, if it doesn't, it sort of doesn't matter. Well, it turns out it matters for a lot of things. It matters for genital birth defects. He's more likely to have undescended testicles if he has a short AGD. He's more likely to have certain defects of the penis, one called hypospadias. He's more likely to develop testicular cancer when he's a young man. And he's more likely to have a low sperm count and to be subfertile. So the bottom line, the arc of this whole 20 years that I've been working on this is that these chemicals, when the mother's exposed to them in early pregnancy, result in failures or limitations of reproductive function in adulthood, and are undoubtedly part of the explanation of the decrease in sperm count and fertility. So phthalates are in plastic. They make plastic soft and flexible. So anytime you see a rubber tubing, I just saw a survey of clothing in which they measured phthalates levels in the clothing and found that they were really high in the vinyl raincoats and boots and anything that included vinyl. So any vinyl products, shower curtains, tubing of any kind, you'll see phthalates in there. But also foods that pass through phthalates. So think about a cow. A cow used to be milked by hand, but then they started using milking machines. The milking machines, you've seen them, they have all these tubes, and those tubes contain phthalates. And so when the milk comes from the cow, goes through the tube, goes into the container, it contains phthalates. And a study in Europe showed actually significantly more phthalates in the milk that was collected in that way compared to by hand, right? So we know that any food that passes through phthalate-containing tubing will contain this phthalate, and it will go into your body, and it'll go into the fetus, and then the harm is done. So another way we get phthalates is in our cosmetics and our personal care products, because not only do they make plastic soft, but they also help retain scent and color. So any lipstick, nail polish, perfume, scented laundry soap, air fresheners, little tags, that pine cones that you hang in your car, they're all going to have lots of phthalates. And by the way, they also increase absorption. So if you put a cream on your hand, you come back 20 minutes later, the cream's gone, right? It's meant to be absorbed. Phthalates help with that. They also help the pesticide get absorbed into the plant. So they're put in pesticides for that reason. So they're just all over. It's hard to find things that don't have these chemicals in them. But by the way, I should add that this is only one class of endocrine disrupting chemicals. It's the one that I've spent the most time on because it's particularly important for the hormone testosterone. But another class of chemicals, bisphenol A, the phenols, I should say the bisphenols, are kind of the opposite. They make plastic hard, and instead of lowering testosterone, they increase estrogen. So the kind of the flip side, if you will. And these are all over the place too. They're in the lining of tin cans, they're in tooth sealants, they're in our pizza boxes, they're in our plastic water bottles, they're in our baby bottles. So that's another class. And then there's flame retardants, and then there's pesticides. And then there's something called the PFAS chemicals, which are things like Teflon, they're coatings. So Teflon, water repellents, paper coverings that keep oil off, like in your pizza boxes, right? So everywhere you look, and there are hundreds of these that are in our bodies right now. And many of them interact. You know, when you go to the doctor, your doctor is going to give you a prescription. She says to you, what else are you taking? Tell me about all your medications, right? So you tell all, she says, nothing else, and you add a few, and then you tell all your medications. And then she thinks about that and thinks about how they might interact with the medication she's going to prescribe. It's the same thing with these chemicals. They act together, and often the whole is worse than the sum of its parts. Just like you wouldn't, you know, you could take one sleeping pill, you could take another sleeping pill, start adding those up, it's not good. I'm very worried about it, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think we do already satisfy several of the criteria for endangerment, which is a step way before extinction. But we are threatened. We're threatened. And remember, if you're a couple, if you're a guy who's trying to get pregnant, your wife or partner wants to get pregnant, that's a right. That's a basic human right that you should be able to reproduce if you want to. No one's talking about everyone should want to. That's not what I'm saying. But if you want to, you should have that opportunity and that right. And to have that taken away from you from causes that are not within your control is what I'm most concerned about. So I think there's a couple of good news items to the story. One is that a lot of the chemicals that are harming us, and phthalates in particular, leave the body very quickly. 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, they're not sticking around. They're not persistent. We call them non-persistent chemicals. That's true of bisphenol A also. So if we can stop taking them in, we're done with them. And that's, I think, a really good news story. It's not like lead, it's not like dioxin, PCBs, and so on, which do stick around. The other part of the story that's helpful is that Pat Hunt, who's an animal toxicologist in the University of Washington, showed that if you take a mouse that's been messed up, has poor reproductive function because of chemical exposures, and then you clean up the environment of his offspring and his offspring's offspring, in three generations, you can restore reproductive function. That's a great story for a mouse or a rat, because their length of life is 2 years. Intergenerational life gap is 2 years. For us, it's longer. That would be 75 years. So we're probably looking at a pretty long time to get it totally cleaned up, but we can start in that direction if we would stop re-exposing kids that were exposed in utero during their childhood and during their adulthood. Then we would be on the road to cleaning up our reproductive health. Hi, thanks for watching this episode of After School. I'm Shauna Swan. I'm a reproductive epidemiologist, and I study how chemicals in the environment affect our reproductive health. For more than 20 years, I've been studying how these chemicals can affect sperm count, whether they're causing it to decline, and why. You can read about this and other scary declines in my book, countdown. Thanks for watching, and I really enjoyed making this video. Thank you.